worst blizzards in American history, strikes the Northeast, killing more than 400 people and dumping as much as 55 inches of snow in some areas. New York City ground to a near halt in the face of massive snow drifts and powerful winds from the storm. At the time, approximately one in every four Americans lived in the area between Washington, D.C. and Maine, and the area affected by the Great Blizzard of 1888. And oh, by the way, we weren't talking about global warming back then. 1861, in Montgomery, Alabama, delegates from South Carolina, Mississippi, Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Texas adopt the permanent Constitution of the Confederate States of America. In 1941, on this day, President Franklin D. Roosevelt's Lend-Lease program, which provides money and materials for allies in the war, goes into effect. In 1942, after struggling against great odds to save the Philippines from Japanese conquest, U.S. General Douglas MacArthur abandons the island fortress under orders from President Franklin Roosevelt. In 1990, Lithuania proclaims its independence from the USSR, which first Soviet republic to do so. The Soviet government responded by imposing an oil embargo and economic stock blockade against the Baltic Republic, and later sent troops. Boy, that sounds familiar. In 2004, on this day, 191 people are killed, at nearly 2,000 are injured, from 10 bombs explode on four trains in three Madrid area train stations during a busy morning rush hour. The bombs were later found to have been detonated by mobile phones, and the attacks, the deadliest against civilians on European soil since the 1988 Lockerbie airplane bombing, were initially suspected to be the work of the Basque separate militant group ETA. This was soon proved incorrect, and evidence mounted against an extreme Islamic militant group, loosely tied to but thought to be working in the name of Al-Qaeda. See, so it's not just here, it's everywhere. In 1818, Frankenstein is published. In 1947, Truman thanks Herbert Hoover for aiding post-W2 reconstruction. And finally in sports, 1901, on this day, the Cincinnati Inquirer reports the signing of a mysterious player named Chief Tokohama to baseball's Baltimore Orioles by manager John McCraw. Chief Tokohama was later revealed to be Charlie Grant, an African-American second baseman. McGraw was attempting to draw upon the great untapped resource of African-American baseball talent in the face of baseball's unspoken rule banning black players from the major leagues. And that is Today in History from History.com for March 11th, 2016. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with more.
This is Big C coming to you from HuntingtonChamberRadio.com at the studio offices of the Huntington County Chamber of Commerce in Flemington, New Jersey. Good Morning Huntington kicks off your day by providing you with local news, traffic, and weather, as well as light topics through Vitamin C, Wake Up Call, and Chamber Chat. I also have many guests focusing on Huntington County community, business, and education. Listen to me every weekday morning from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Good Morning Huntington, HuntingtonChamberRadio.com.
Lose 20. 20 to 40 pounds in 40 days, guaranteed. Let me repeat, lose 20 to 40 pounds in 40 days, guaranteed. This is not a crazy diet or exercise program. No drugs, hormones, or shots. You can lose 20 to 45 pounds in 40 days with Nutrimost Resonant Frequency Technology to measure 2,800 of your body's key biomarkers. Using NRF, they can find and correct the cause of your weight problem by measuring factors affecting weight gain, including metabolism, fat burning, fat storage, appetite, detoxification, and hormonal regulation. It's safe, fast, easy, and effective, and you won't walk around hungry or have cravings. It's even doctor supervised. Schedule a body composition analysis and consultation. You can be transformed in 40 days guaranteed. This is a limited time offer, so they can't wait to see you look great.
So call 888-718-7077. That's 888-718-7077. Or visit njthin.com. That's njthin.com.
Let Stowaway Self-Storage be your local moving and storage solution. With three great locations in Hunterdon County, Stowaway is conveniently located in Flemington, White House, and Lebanon. Stowaway Self-Storage offers sizes from 5x5 to 50x50, discounted packing supplies, and U-Haul rentals on site. Affordable monthly rentals for your personal and business use, let Stowaway help you park your car in the garage again or store those old records that you need to keep. Visit us at stowawayselfstorage.com and mention this ad to receive 50% off your first month's rent.
Well, good afternoon on this beautiful Friday afternoon. It is gorgeous out there. A little breezy sometimes, but it's still great for a March 11th. And what about the weather for the weekend? Well, let me see if I can read this. But today, what we should see today is mostly clear tonight. And if I can see the rest of it, tomorrow they're saying mostly sunny. I heard some rain, but no, apparently mostly sunny tomorrow, about 58 degrees. So not quite as warm, but it should be a beautiful day. Saturday night, mostly cloudy. And then we have a chance of showers on Sunday, about a 30% chance. And the high will be about 61 degrees. Into Monday and Tuesday, there is a greater chance of showers. And Monday, we're likely to have showers, 60%. Again, in the low 50s, so it's not going to be cold. And a chance of showers both Sunday night, Monday, and Monday night. Actually, likely that we're going to have some rain on Sunday night. So the day to get out is definitely tomorrow, when it's going to be mostly sunny and high near 58 degrees. Warmer some places and perhaps not as warm in other places. Well, I'm Pat Smits, your host for It's the Law, and it's 4 o'clock on Friday, so it's the law. And I was looking for an article that I had read. For some reason, New Jersey gets in the news, and not the kind of news that we would always like to hear. And, you know, the latest about our governor is I think he's getting more press for his facial gestures when he was standing behind Donald Trump than he got throughout his entire campaign. But in any event, what else is happening? Now the New Jersey Supreme Court have okayed the use of what they call roving wiretaps. And so that is in the case is State versus Feliciano, and it was a 46-page opinion authored by Chief Justice Ravner. And basically what the opinion boils down to is that when a target, meaning a suspect or a target, purposely changes facilities to avoid detection, in that situation, law enforcement officers may switch over and begin to monitor a new facility under the state's wiretap law. And they can do that provided that they have otherwise fully complied with the statute. So going forward, law enforcement must notify a wiretap judge within 48 hours of the switch and obtain authorization to continue monitoring the new facility. But this is certainly going to help law enforcement that they won't have to keep going back and getting new authorizations, so that they have to, however, comply with the statute, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the situation, and that is a Supreme Court case worth reading for anyone who handles criminal law matters. There was another Supreme Court decision with respect to labor and employment, probably, you know, not that interesting for most of us. It's an alleging an unfair practice charges against Atlantic County, and there was a reversal of a hearing examiner's award in favor of public employees. And in reliance of that decision, they dismissed the grievance and blah, 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 blah. And so, it's, as I said, anybody who's interested in that, I'm sure, has already, you know, found out about it. So, we have to be careful. Everyone has to be careful of sexist remarks. There was a sexist remark and ticket fixing and some other things that were alleged against a municipal court judge. And he's agreed to a lifetime ban from the bench. Now, as most people know, municipal court judges are attorneys, and most of them have an active practice as well as sitting on the municipal court bench. Frankly, they handle all kinds of issues, and it's pretty amazing to me that they can do all of that. They're truly the general jurists of the state. Most of us would only be in front of them if we have a speeding ticket that we decide not to pay, or go to court to see if we can work out some kind of a better deal. So there is another case where the supervisor's discriminatory actions, even though it creates a multitude of issues for an employer, it does not in and of itself create liability where the supervisor is not the termination decision maker. So, again, anyone who has employees should be talking to their attorney about these cases, should be finding out about them, finding out what, in fact, you know, as an employer, you need to do to handle these situations so that you do not become liable. And, of course, one of the problems is, as we all know, that whether or not you're found guilty or found liable, the process is so incredibly difficult and expensive that what better thing is to try to prevent any of these problems from occurring. Well, let's see what else is happening. Again, a Bridgegate class suit plaintiffs are fighting dismissal after retooling their complaint to incorporate more specific allegations. The plaintiffs in a civil suit over the Bridgegate scandal are once again battling assertions that their case fails to bring actionable claims. In other words, to file a lawsuit, you have to have some basis under the law, and the defendants in that case are saying that they have no basis, meaning the plaintiffs have no basis. New Jersey lawmakers have once again attempted to enact legislation that would make it easier for defendants who are subject to lawsuits because of their participation in politically or commercially sensitive issues to have those lawsuits dismissed. So that's one of the concerns always of certainly anyone who is politically active. They're always concerned about lawsuits. Well, maybe a lot of people are concerned about them. Now, a New York law firm handled, a firm that handled federal securities litigation on behalf of stockholders in a now defunct auto parts manufacturing company has succeeded in obtaining dismissal of a suit lodged by a New Jersey class member claiming legal malpractice. So that's got to be a big win because it was a $12.3 million case. Now, there, many of us have heard about Uber, and the taxi company's unfair competition suit against Uber survives, and it was pared down to the simple issue of whether Uber makes false representations to the public that Philadelphia's taxi companies weren't guaranteed to be insured while on the road. And a federal judge has allowed the cab company's unfair competition lawsuit against Uber to move forward. So that, as you can imagine, many companies are up in arms about the competition from Uber. Now, there was also a criminal law case, and it was Supreme Court, State v. Thompson, and Justice Solomon. And he, in his opinion, he wrote, "The record below demonstrates that the prosecutor's race-neutral reasons for striking the jurors were supported by the record, and that the trial court conducted an adequate Gilmore analysis." And therefore, the appellate division that had reversed and remanded for a new trial, the Supreme Court said that their decision was inappropriate. So they supported the trial judge's decision. Now, there's been some consumer protection cases that have not been published. One defendants, Dream Cars National LLC, and some other defendants are in the business of renting exotic and luxury cars. And in this case, the plaintiff entered into an agreement with them to rent I think it was a Lamborghini. Let me double check. Yes, it was a Lamborghini. And that was to be used during the 2012 Gumball 3000 rally. And the defendants advertised and promoted the use of their vehicles for the rally. And in fact, the advertisement listed the Lamborghini as costing $32,500. The plaintiff agreed to pay defendants $32,500 to rent the Lamborghini for the rally. The rental agreement contained several provisions that formed the basis of plaintiff's individual and putative class claims arising under New Jersey's Truth in Consumer Contract Warranty and Notice Act. Very important for businesses to be aware of this law. And it's the New Jersey Truth in Consumer Contract Warranty and Notice Act. And in this case, the plaintiff made a separate claim under the New Jersey Consumer Fraud Act. And to support his Consumer Fraud Act claim, the plaintiff relied on a number of purported incidents that arose from the defendant's advertisement of the vehicle and also continued during his operation of the vehicle and return of it. According to the plaintiff, he requested a refund of the security deposit. The defendants refused, instead applying a portion of the security deposit without authorization of the plaintiff as compensation for alleged damage to the vehicle. Then the defendants purportedly withheld the remainder of the security deposit in anticipation of plaintiff's rental fee for various damages, including $58,000 for loss of use of the vehicle at the rate of $1,950 per day for 30 days, as well as body repair and key replacement. And then the defendants also invoiced the plaintiff for services provided during the rental period in the amount of $3,678. So in the case, the court granted the defendant's motion to dismiss the claims, at least the claims under the Truth in Consumer Contract Warranty and Notice Act. And the court, however, denied the defendant's motion to dismiss the plaintiff's Consumer Fraud Act claim. And the court found that the plaintiff sufficiently alleged that the defendant's advertisement was misleading insofar as it misrepresented or omitted material terms related to the total charge associated with renting the vehicle. So you have to be very, very, very precise. So what the court said is, taking the plaintiff's allegations as true, then the defendant engaged in a course of unconscionable acts described, or proscribed, I should say, by the CFA, the Consumer Fraud Act. And that would have included distributing a misleading advertisement, delivering a not-as-advertised product, and assessing spurious repair and or replacement charges in excess of the originally advertised contract price. Moreover, plaintiff allegedly, alleged sufficient facts to withstand a motion for summary judgment, or in this case, withstand the defendant's contentions that the advertisement was mere puffery. So the people who were doing the advertising said it was just puffery, nothing more. And the court said, nope, the other side can go forward. Now, there was a case where an appellate division court refused to expand the scope of the state's child sex abuse law to make public schools liable when a student is assaulted by a school employee. Important case for, certainly for anyone, any school district. It's very important. So that was the case of Smith, J.P. versus Smith et al. And it was decided, sometime this past week, could have been Monday. And the case involved the claims of a sexual abuse by the plaintiff, J.P., against defendants Southern Regional High School and Southern Regional School Board. And I'll refer to both of them as the school. In her complaint that was filed in September 2014, plaintiff alleged that in 2004, so now remember this was 10 years earlier, she was subjected to repeated sexual abuse by the school's assistant band director, and his name was Gregory Smith. The acts of abuse allegedly occurred at the school where she was a student during two school-organized overnight trips and in the plaintiff's home. So the plaintiff sought damages pursuant to the Child Sexual Abuse Act, and that is a very specific statute. If anyone is interested, you can find it at NJSA 2A61B-1, and also under various common law theories of tort liability. So the Child Sexual Abuse Act definition of passive sexual abuse limits the class of persons who are potentially liable to those who are, and it's a quote, within the household. Now, the court distinguished another case. That was the Hardwick versus the American Boys Choir School, and that was a Supreme Court case in 2006. And they concluded that the school, which was a public day school, is not liable as a passive abuser under the statute because it does not fit within the statutory definition. So accordingly, they affirmed the dismissal of the claim against the school. And they further concluded that the plaintiff's common law claims accrued no later than July 2013, when the plaintiff's expert opined that she fully understood she had been abused, meaning that when the plaintiff's expert opined that the plaintiff fully understood that she had been abused and the consequences of that abuse. Therefore, the court held that there was no hearing necessary to determine the date the common law claims accrued or started, because those claims were barred due to the plaintiff's failure to comply with the notice provisions of the Tort Claims Act. And so they reversed that portion of the order under review, and they reinstated the common law claims and ordered a hearing. So any time that anyone is involved in, you know, something like this, they really can't just sit back and wait. They need to let people know, and they need to deal with it. So that is a good reminder that you can't sit on your rights. Now, there's a federal judge in Camden who has refused to dismiss an indemnification claim filed by two food suppliers against a sandwich manufacturer in a suit over contaminated ham sandwiches sold by Starbucks. Obviously, very important situation, very significant situation, if in fact the sandwiches were contaminated. So that was that case is pending, and it's whether or not there is indemnification, meaning that the manufacturer has to indemnify the food suppliers. And apparently they were sued. I don't really know much about that case. Now, a federal judge in Newark has denied a motion to disqualify a law firm, Day Pitney, from representing the defendants in a dispute between business partners. And the judge found that there was no evidence that the firm used its prior representation of the plaintiff to gain an unfair advantage in the present case. So that's very significant among lawyers, because it's in New Jersey, it's usually if there's not only a conflict but any appearance of a conflict, it can be very difficult to do anything and stay in the case, and would be a means to get someone out of a case. And it happens often. So now the interplay between the U.S. Bankruptcy Code and other federal laws often requires the courts to balance competing federal policy considerations. And so why am I saying that? Well, apparently the Third Circuit, which is our circuit, permitted debtors to trump rights under an expired code, bankruptcy code. So that would be a little bit unusual. So let's come back. I had given you the weather. I don't think that's changed. But let's play a couple spots from our sponsors, and then we'll continue.
Home Instead Senior Care. It's our passionate dedication to creating personal relationships between our clients and our caregivers. Visit our website at www.homeinstead.com/325. You've got a friend.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
Well, I wish my friend John Manfreda was here to discuss the next case that I want to discuss. And but once again, it is a kind of a warning that, number one, it is critically important that everyone has a will. Also, I'd like to remind everybody that when you execute your will, figure out who's going to keep the original. Very often, attorneys will keep the originals. And however, your executor needs to have at least a copy. And there needs to be, family members need to know where the copy of your will is. The reason I say that is I had a call, and I've spent probably an hour trying to track down whether or not I could find out who drafted a will for a former client. Her children called me, and I had represented her many years ago, but her children called me because she died, and they could not find the will. They thought perhaps I had prepared the will, but I had not, and so I called various people that I thought. I called my former firm, but we could not track down the will. And it will be much more, it'll be more expensive, more difficult in this case if, in fact, they can't find the will. And so far, the only person they think might have had it, might have handled it, is now in his late 80s and has not practiced for probably 20 years at least. So remember, most important to have a will. I think you're very foolish if you go on the internet and try to use a form. And the reason I say that is New Jersey is very specific. So it's important to have a will that conforms to New Jersey law. It's not that expensive to have an attorney who knows what he or she is doing to draft the will. And that way you can also understand the provisions that you're putting in the will. And when I say that, often people don't understand what they're really saying. And that's the case I'm going to talk to you about. It's not been approved for publication yet. However, the issue in this case and the court determined as a matter of law that all six of the deceased trust settlers' grandchildren are beneficiaries under the trust. And I'm going to be back and finish this in just a minute. I need to close the door.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Well, I'm back and I'm talking about the estate case. And as I said, it's very important to be very careful, and also timing can be critical. But in this case, the settlor, and that's the person who set up the trust, and in this case, Miss Nelson had grandchildren. And so that the judge in this case found that as a matter of law, all six of her grandchildren, and she was a deceased trust settlor, but let's just say the grandmother who set up a trust, all of her grandchildren were beneficiaries of a trust because the trust said specifically, settlor's grandchildren. So that in quote, settlor's grandchildren. So the argument was whether or not two grandchildren who were in existence at the time that she created the trust but not named in the trust are entitled to share because of the term settler's grandchildren. So the issue, if there were grandchildren born after the trust was set up, there would be the assumption that these grandchildren would be included. But what is the outcome if, in fact, she had six grandchildren but only named four of them, on the other hand, talked about all of her grandchildren? So the court said that in the judge's view, the judge could not use extrinsic evidence to support a finding that the settler, the grandmother, actually intended to deny those two grandchildren, not named, beneficiary status under the trust. Now, apparently after oral argument on this issue and before the court's decision, New Jersey adopted the Uniform Trust Code on January 19th, 2016. And then among the provisions of the new law is the following, and I am going to have John Manfreda on the program to talk about the new law. But it said there's a provision in the new law that's entitled Reformation to Correct Mistakes. And the court may reform the terms of a trust, even if unambiguous, to conform the terms to the settlor's probable intent, if it is proved by clear and convincing evidence that there was a mistake of fact or law, whether in expression or in inducement. So that's new. And in addition, the new law entitled Construction to Conform Trust Terms to Probate Intent of Settlor provides the following. Nothing in this act shall prevent the court from construing the terms of a trust, even if unambiguous, to confirm to the settlor's probable intent. So this could open up a lot of litigation where, for example, in this case, the settlor talked about her grandchildren and didn't, even though in another part of the trust named specific grandchildren, because of that general language and the fact that it was prior to the new statute, the trial judge said all six grandchildren are entitled. So in this case, the plaintiffs asked the court to reconsider its decision based on the argument that the Uniform Trust Code has altered the foundational premises which were relied upon by the court in its original decision. And so that's the argument that they made, and they said, and of course quoting the language, that the court may reform terms of a trust even if unambiguous to conform the terms to the settlor's probable intent. And so they were asking the court, based on this new law, to reconsider its decision and to not deny the defendant's motion for partial summary judgment. And their motion for partial summary judgment was to name all six of the grandchildren, include all six of the grandchildren. Now, the defendant objects, noting that the new law, by the express terms of the law, does not take effect until 180 days following the enactment. And that's pretty usual. Very often there will be a 90-day or 180-day wait before a law takes effect. In fact, we had one now, and I think I talked about it last week, that the law passed in February does not go into effect until next February. So that is a very long time. But that is the legislature does determine when a law goes into effect. So the plaintiffs here who want all of the children in argued that the text of the new law does not, in fact, bar its current application, and that the court can and should and perhaps must apply it. So the trustee points to the language application to existing relationships, and that's set out in the that was set out in the briefs that they supplied and the motions that they supplied to the court. Now, the decision from the court, of course, the court used the Rule 4:49-2, which is for a motion for rehearing or reconsideration, and this is what that was. If that motion for rehearing or reconsideration seeks to alter or amend a judgment or order, it shall be served not later than 20 days after service of the judgment or order upon all parties. Motion shall state with specifically state the basis on which it is made, including a statement of matters or controlling decisions. Now, the trial judge in this case said that trial judge who was, let me see if I know that judge. Robert Cantillo. The judge said that he did not recall either of the attorneys referring to the Uniform Trust Code in the summary judgment motion papers or at oral argument. In other words, he's saying, hey, guys, you didn't bring it up either in your papers or at oral argument. And the judge said it was not referenced in the court's decision or in the corrected decision. I guess this went around and around. But in any event, the Uniform Trust Code was adopted into law on January 19th, 2016, and its existence was not known to the court at the time of the argument or decision. Had it been known, the trial judge said he would have addressed it. And while that reality prompts the court to reconsider its decision, the result is the same. Plaintiff's motion for summary judgment cannot be granted, and the defendant's motion for partial summary judgment may be granted. In fact, the judge said it must be granted. And that was for the reasons set forth in the court's decision under reconsideration. Talk about getting a little bit confused here. So we all know, or lawyers know, that when the new act takes effect, its provisions will bind all with the force of law. At that point, the rules of construction that apply in New Jersey to the interpretation of and disposition of property will also be applied as appropriate to interpretation of the terms of a trust and the disposition of trust property. So going forward, of course, the statute controls. So I'll be right back.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's physician referral service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Okay, sorry to kind of cut in and out here, but they keep walking in and out of the studio, and it's a little hard to concentrate. But in any event, getting back to this, the judge said that he didn't and was not aware of the existence of this Uniform Trust Code that was adopted on January 19th. And had it been known to the court, either during oral argument or the decision, the trial judge would have addressed it. And he said that while that reality prompts the court to reconsider its decision, the result is the same. And he went on to say that the new law expressly provides that it would not take effect until July 17th, 2016. And when the new act takes effect, the provisions will bind all with the force of law. And on that date, the laws and the rules of construction that apply in this state to the interpretation of and disposition of property by will also apply as appropriate to the interpretation of the terms of a trust and the disposition of trust property. So at that point, the new law, of course, the judges would have to comply and interpret based on that law. And then the judge said, when in the near future the act goes into effect, it applies to all trusts created before, on, or after its effective date. And by the way, that is important. someone can't say, well, you know, my trust or the trust I'm concerned about was, you know, is 20 years old, therefore this new law doesn't apply. That's not true. The law will, in fact, when it goes into effect, apply to all trusts created before, on, or after its effective date. And that's very important in statutes to find out when it is effective. There's a statute, I think I talked about it last time, that was enacted in February, and I've said this a few times, enacted in February. However, it's not going to be implemented until February of 2017. So that you have to be very careful as to, you know, when a statute is going to be implemented. So the judge also gave some good reasoning. He said judicial proceedings that are ongoing at the time the act goes into effect will be determined under the act unless the court finds an application of a particular provision of the act would substantially interfere with the effective conduct of judicial proceedings. So he's recognizing, however, the provision he is holding is not and will not be applicable to judicial proceedings commenced and concluded prior to its effective date. So that's the issue. In this case, the proceedings, not only they commenced, but they actually concluded prior to the effective date of the statute. So I think that was probably the most important thing in this particular case. I do think it's, well, in any event, let's see, talk from a couple of our sponsors. And as I said, I'm going to have John Manfreda in and talk more about trust, why it's important to set them up, what are some of the pitfalls, and I'll try to get John in within the next few weeks. So just hold on. We'll be back after you hear a little bit more from some of our sponsors.
Hi, this is Ruth Ann Disatel, celebrant officiant with Celebration of a Lifetime. When people ask me why I joined the Chamber, it's because I want to get to know you and what you're all about. And I want you to get to know me and what I'm all about. And together, I'd like to celebrate what we can do for Hunterdon County.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Hey, this is Big C of Good Morning Hunterdon on HuntertonChamberRadio.com. Like what you hear on Hunterdon Chamber Radio? Now you can take it with you. Download our Hunterdon Chamber Radio app from iTunes and Google Play Store now. Get schedules, station information, listen live or to the latest podcasts. Everything in the palm of your hand or in your car during your commute. Get the HuntertonChamberRadio.com app today.
This is Tony Clark, Parrot Planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Okay, we're back. Actually, someone asked me this question, and it's kind of not something we've been talking about, but they were asking me about, you know, what judges have to consider when they're awarding alimony. Now, I'm not talking about whether it's long-term, short-term, or whatever, but the question is what in the way of income is income, I guess was the question. And so the courts have provided that the income available to either party through investment of any assets held in held by that party has to be considered. And there was a case where explained the courts have consistently held that a supporting spouse's assets may be considered in calculating an alimony award. So that's an important consideration. Someone can't just put all of their, for example, put all of their money in trust and then say, gee, I don't have any money. I only earn, $20,000 a year. That's all I earn. And so my alimony should be based on that. Not going to happen because the assets may be considered in calculating an alimony award. Now, courts don't, if someone has a retirement account and they're not retirement age, they certainly don't consider that money for alimony because the person who is the account, who has the account, the retirement account, that person can't touch that money at that point either. So there's also the question of analyzing a defendant's ability to pay alimony. There was the question is if there are assets, what rate do you put on it for a conservative, if it's conservative or not conservative, but what's the rate that you would put on the income if, in fact, someone decides not to take income? So in the case I'm thinking of, the what the trial judge did when he, I'm trying to remember who it was. I don't remember who the trial judge was in this case. But in any event, the trial judge applied a conservative 1.8% annual interest rate for Treasury inflation-protected securities. And that's what the judge used to these amounts and considered the additional interest income a little more than $5,000. So they rejected the contention that the judge erred by awarding the other party expert and counsel fees. And the as to the counsel fees, the her attorney argued that, let's see, what did he argue? What we do know is a family part judge may award counsel fees in its discretion. So there are some provisions of a rule that we have to follow when we're applying for legal fees, but in fact the judge has a lot of leeway in deciding whether or not to award counsel fees in matrimonial cases. Most other litigation, there is no such thing as a divorce. I shouldn't say that. There, of course, there is such a thing as a divorce. But other than in divorce, most cases, there is no award of counsel fees. Everybody has to pay their own. So I guess I should go back and clarify that because I really did misspeak. In most litigation in the United States, the winner is not paid legal fees, and the loser does not have to pay legal fees. Now, there are certainly exceptions, and one of the exceptions is family law cases. So that's, you know, one thing that people are always concerned about. And, of course, the courts must consider the factors set forth in the rule and the financial circumstances of the parties and the good and bad faith of either party. So that all goes into the consideration. Now, in the case that was under appeal, the husband had to pay 75% of the plaintiff's counsel fees. And The defendant in that case argued that the fee award is based on erroneous assumptions regarding his ability to pay is meritless. I can't explain it. So, let's see what else we're going to come back in just a moment.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's physician referral service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Okay, we have a few more minutes, and I'm just trying to see what else might be of interest. Criminal law, there are always appeals. Family law, not so much, although there are appeals from motions. However, most of the time they're not ripe for appeal. Again, I think I might have said last week, the question is why and what's the motivation behind Governor Christie's decision to raise Democrats' ire by again nominating a Republican to state Supreme Court. And there's a lot of theories, but one is that he's using local politics to play to a national crowd. Now, there's a lot of speculation as to what he wants in return if, in fact, a Republican is elected, as president. And certainly he's very quickly put his support behind Donald Trump, which to some people was rather surprising that he would do so that quickly. But in any event, he did, and, New Jersey continues to be in the news. Obviously, sometimes not exactly the way we would like it. Talking about the Supreme Court, apparently a White House official held a conference call on Thursday with Asian American and Pacific Islander leaders to discuss the U.S. Supreme Court vacancies because several Asian American judges have been discussed as leading candidates for the late Justice Anton Scalia's seat. There will be we need somebody to be nominated, go through the process, and whatever happens, happens. But, unfortunately, we can't let everything at a standstill, or I certainly don't think we should or could. We can, but it's not the right thing to do, and it's certainly not the what we want to show to the world. And I think that we have to start looking a little bit at how some of this looks to, other nations, and what kind of respect are they going to have for some of what's been going on. I don't think much. So in any event, what else? I'm just trying to see if there's something else that might be of interest. We only have a couple more minutes. And, two things. One, anyone who's divorced and or going through a divorce should talk about what happens when children, reach the age that they're driving. Because obviously that can be a big expense, even if a new vehicle is not purchased, but the child has to go on the custodial parents insurance unless the child has a car of his or her own. So the question is, does child support guidelines, do they include the insurance or other vehicle costs? Now, there was a Supreme Court Family Practice Committee, and I served on that committee for many, many years, and